And this hour, we're going to take your phone calls with John Lott, author, researcher, as we talk about your money and guns. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back with John Lott, and we'll take your phone calls for this hour. John, in your opinion, do you see any break at all in the unemployment? Is that going to pick up at any point soon?
No, I don't think it's going to be very soon. We have a couple problems here. The biggest problem is that right now the unemployment rate understates how bad the picture is, because a lot of people just completely left the labor market. They're not looking for jobs. You have almost 4 million people since the beginning of last year have just stopped looking for jobs. And so when the situation starts to improve, even if you start having a fair number of new jobs eventually being created, the unemployment rate's not going to go down for a while, because a lot of these people are going to start to look again for jobs. And so, the pool of people in the labor force is going to get larger at that point, because you're only counted as being in the labor force if you tell the surveyors that you're actively looking for work.
Actively looking, so it's much bigger than that. Yeah.
And, if you look at the people who are unemployed, the people who have taken part-time jobs when they really want to get full-time jobs, and people who have just given up looking for jobs completely, the true unemployment rate, including those things, is actually about 17% right now, which is pretty bad historically. And now, part of that, I think, is due to the long unemployment insurance benefits that we've said before. So maybe that exaggerates. My own guess is probably about 3.5% of the unemployment rate, from that 17% level, would probably be due to the fact that we just have so much longer benefits than we've had in the past. But, there are real problems, and part of that, again, I think, is due to all the chaos and churning that's been created in the economy, with moving trillions of dollars around, creating regulations that move hundreds of billions or even trillions of other dollars around. That has an impact when you move the money and you move the jobs that are connected with the money. People don't move instantly from one job to another.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up, first of all, by going to Riverside, California. Mike, you're with us west of the Rockies. Hey, Mike, thanks for calling.
George, let me just say what an honor it is talking to you. And I want to tell you that Frank Sinatra song you play every once in a while, we've turned it, my wife and I have been married 42 years, we've turned it into our song. But anyway, I was just wanting to ask you and John, how much do you think of an effect this over-financing we're doing on people that are underwater on their houses? How much effect is that going to have on us later on in life for our children and grandchildren?
Well, thanks. I think the big problem is we're going to have to pay, somebody's going to have to pay for those mortgages when they actually go into default. We think it's on the cheap right now because we're just promising them when those mortgages go bad, we'll have to bail them out at that time. So right now, you don't see any expenditures. It's only going to be a year or two or three down the road that you're going to see the bills coming through. And, and even then, once something goes into default, it can be up to a year before you can get somebody to move out in many jurisdictions. Just the courts don't deal with these things quickly. So, you may have to add another year onto that before we really start seeing the financial bills come in for these things. But, it's just pushing the problem down the road, and it's doing so at a big cost, and we're giving lots of money to Wall Street-type people that they don't deserve. I mean, this is not, if you want to make the housing market better and you want to really spend all this money, what you would do is you would go and deal with future sales. You wouldn't go and subsidize things, decisions that have been made years in the past. If I go and I bought one of these mortgages 2 years ago, let's say when the problems were occurring, and virtually all these mortgages have been resold, the original lender doesn't own this anymore. They're usually some type of financial houses on Wall Street or someplace else that have bought these and bundled them into essentially bonds, that, you know, for them, it's just a windfall. You know, they own these pieces of paper just as if they own bonds in Ford or bonds in IBM or something like that. And you're going and saying, well, we're going to guarantee a portion of these bonds, and the value of the bonds would just go up. So it doesn't, it's not like you're tying these payments that you're making to some future sales of houses that are going to be occurring.
Why isn't there, John, some kind of aggressive change to the income tax and, you know, to come up with something modern and efficient that works for everybody, gives people more money to spend? Why don't they come up with something creative?
Well, I mean, these things are broached, and there's lots of good ideas there. You know, I think this is one thing Ronald Reagan understood a lot, that you want to try to reduce the rates and get rid of the deductions. If you were to go and ask an economist how to set up the ideal tax system, they'd say you want to have the rates as low as possible, and you want to have it so that the government doesn't tell people how they're supposed to spend their money, that they know best how to do it, and government shouldn't be subsidizing certain things and making it more or less costly for people to make different decisions in their lives. And the other thing is that the tax system should be stable. You shouldn't be increasing rates and decreasing them and changing the rules from one year to another. Unfortunately, right now, it's like everything's going wrong. We're raising the marginal tax rate. We're making all these changes that are being put forward in these stimulus rules are temporary. And there's just huge deductions. I mean, it's mind-boggling going through something like this small business jobs bill. It's like page after page. You can make these types of investments and you get big write-offs, but you can't make these. You can buy this type of computer or this type of software and you'll get a deduction, but you can't buy this. If you buy this, you don't get any money. It's just, you know, it's amazing micromanaging of the decisions that people have to be making. And if, you know, I guess the people in Washington think that they know much better than the businesses that have their own money at stake where the best places are to invest. But, you know, I guess most economists and myself believe that people who have their own money at stake are a lot more careful in figuring out where the best place, where the most productive place for them to invest it is than somebody who it isn't their money.
Let's go to Miles driving his truck in Kentucky east of the Rockies. Hi, Miles. Thanks for calling.
Morning, George.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to hope that you start feeling a little bit better. Your tone of voice has not been as upbeat recently as it has been in the past. So I hope this stuff doesn't all get you down.
I'm okay, Miles. No big deal.
But John has a real good way of explaining things. He's really made a lot of things clear. I go back to the 80s when I got out of college. I was in the accounting area. And coming out of the 70s into the 80s, our unemployment in our area was right around 22, 24% was auto workers and all that. And I'd like to hear what John has to say about how we got out of that. He mentioned Reagan a minute ago, and I've always felt that Reagan, with his faults, had a good idea on what to do to get the economy going, because what I saw was small businesses that were starting, were flourishing, and a lot of that had to do with the tax changes that were made in 83. And a lot of that had to do with, to help small businesses, they had ceilings or limits on what they could invest. Say a large corporation go out and spend $10 million, well, you know, a small corporation, that might help too. But if a small corporation or the law says that you have $200,000, that's not going to help a big business as much as it would a small business. So I wanted to hear what John had to say, how he came out of that, and if we can do something like that again. I don't think this present administration is going to help, but can we do it?
All right. Go ahead, John.
No, well, there's one thing that Reagan understood really well, and that is that incentives matter. That if you go and let people keep a larger percentage of the money that they earn, they'll work harder, and the whole pie will get bigger. you know, Obama has a completely different view on that. You know, he kind of expressed it when he talked to Joe the Plumber during the 2008 campaign, where he says, I think when you spread wealth around, it's good for everybody. But, you know, if you raise the taxes and give people money that they don't have to work more to go and get, that's not giving the incentive to make the overall pie bigger. In fact, if anything, it makes the pie smaller. And so, you know, that's one thing there. But the what happened in the late 70s and the early 80s, it's quite a bit different than what we've had now. What happened in at the end of the Carter administration, we had inflation that was like 14% during the last quarter that that Carter was in office. And it's really hard to go and bring down inflation rates like that, because workers and everybody else has expectations about prices keep on going up in the future. And so if you're an employer and you see that the inflation rate's starting to come down, and that's the real thing that Reagan did at that time, is he refused to give in the political pressure to go and have the money supply keep on expanding. He bit the bullet, got it down, but businesses see that the demand for their products goes down, that people, as inflation isn't keep on rising at 14%, you know, maybe now they'll only pay 5% more for the product rather than 14, but that means that they have to pay their workers less. They can't pay them a 14% raise. And those types of expectations are hard to adjust, because some people say, well, I think I should keep on getting 14% because I'm worried about inflation. And some people won't make the agreements then.
It was always going to burst eventually, John. I mean, right. I remember back in high school just, you know, looking at prices on everything, saying that at this rate, 25 years from now, and here we are right around that time period, this we just can't sustain it. Is this healthy, what's happening now, as bizarre as it is, as tough as it is for so many people? Is it healthy?
No. I mean, I think it's in so many ways, we're just pushing problems off to the future, and we're making ourselves much poorer. You know, so much of the stimulus, as we mentioned last hour, is moving money and investment to things that people wouldn't have invested in on their own, that they weren't producing a good return on. And for the government to go and give money then on those things, for something that you wouldn't invest in yourself, you're taking a drop in returns. Our wealth is going to grow at a slower rate than it would have grown otherwise. And we're building up a huge debt. You know, just 10 years, just the increase in the deficit that we have over these 10 years, that's equal to like $130,000 for a family of four. And so one question that people have to ask themselves is, what else could I have spent this $130,000 on? You know, am I getting government services, because the government still would have been operating. I mean, you go back to what the spending was in 2008 and say, is the additional spending that we're getting, is the additional benefit that I'm getting that I wasn't getting 2 years ago from the government worth taking on $130,000 in debt for a family of four? You know, and my guess is most people probably aren't going to think they're getting that much more in benefits. But it's something that they and their kids and their grandkids are going to have to be paying back. You don't quickly pay back those types of debts. And it's just not those things. One of the things that the IMF report that we talked about earlier really emphasized a lot is they were very concerned about the increased future debt even past those 10 years because of the new health care bill that got passed. They said that they believed that it was wildly out of whack in terms of funding. And you know, the other things they mentioned, they were concerned about Social Security and Medicare also, which are problems that haven't been dealt with for a long time. You know, Social Security, we've been getting in more money than we've been paying out for a while now. We've been using it to kind of hide how big the deficits are. But in the next couple years, as the baby boom begins to move into retirement, you know, the piper is going to come due. I mean, it's not like the types of 401k plans which everybody has, where you put money aside, it's there, it's growing, and you can draw that down. Social Security is largely set up as a welfare program where people who are working right now pay taxes that immediately directly goes to pay the benefits for other people. And when the system was first set up, you may have had like 25 people working for everyone that was on Social Security. In the next few years, we're going to be going to a situation where you're going to have two people working for every person that's on Social Security. And, you know, we're going to have the normal deficits, plus we're going to be having the fact that we're going to be having to make up this loss as this baby boom retires. And that, when you add the Medicare things, and, you know, we can go and criticize Bush in terms of the additional benefits that they pushed through on Medicare, but this health care change that we have is going to dwarf a lot of that. I mean, it's essentially going to take, if you believe the IMF, it's going to be taking the types of problems that we have with Medicare and essentially apply it to the whole population.
All right, let's take a call before the break. Michael in Honolulu in Hawaii on the wildcard line. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, I agree much with what you're saying, George. I mean, your guess is excellent. One point you may want to consider, though, is the amount of money that the United States has simply being funneled out of the country to other countries. It's like having a patient on intravenous transfusion, but the money's just bleeding out of the country, and it's largely to support a very exclusive corporate elite. The corporate elite that basically covers basically almost the media, and we get this spin, and it even took over the country to spill billions of dollars, trillions of dollars into Iraq and Afghanistan, gutting the entire American economy. This is the biggest challenge we face now, is the gutting of the United States, having all this money fueled overseas, and having the corporate world simply control us, even to the point where they control the Supreme Court and can put more money in elections than the public can. And I'd be nice to know what your comments are upon that.
Well, all right. Pretty interesting. John, just about the minute and a half. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, some money is going overseas from the stimulus. You know, it's not exactly obvious what type of argument you would make for why that's the case. My concern is just the huge amount of money that's moving around, you know, and giving to people just solely based upon whether they're politically favored or not. And that's as bad to me, no matter who's getting it, if they're not getting it because of something that they're producing.
Well, I don't know if anybody's going to be able to get us out of this mess right now. You know, maybe it'll happen by itself if we left it alone.
I mean, there are some good proposals. Ryan from Wisconsin has a layout. Part of what he's saying is let's return the spending levels to what they were in 2008. And, you know, just eliminate a lot of these new programs that we have. Try to go back to there, and then you can start talking about making changes from that point. Just that by itself would eliminate a huge percentage of this deficit. If you go back to just 2006, we had a deficit of, or 2007, we had a deficit of $160 billion. I mean, now, the last 2 years, we've been talking about deficits over $1.3
trillion. Yeah, I know. It's crazy. John, stay with us. We're going to come back with some final phone calls with you in just a moment on coasttocoastam.com. John Lott has his own blog site that is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now as well. And if you haven't had a chance to go to the brand new website, go ahead. You'll get used to it. It's got a great carousel. We do polls every once in a while. It's really magnificent. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we join astrologer Mark Lerner to get his words of wisdom of future events through the eyes of an astrologer. And when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with John Lott right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, well, this half hour is going to buzz by very quickly, so we'll go back to John Lott and take final calls. Douglas is in Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Douglas. Thanks for holding.
Hello, George. Hi. I was thinking about the stimulus package, you know, how it was really benefited the country as far as steering us away from the depression that we were really facing at the time of its configuration. And, you know, also the benefits that I see that we could have benefited better off of bridge and road repair if we would have probably taken and charged for maybe $25 for the individual tags and $100 for the commercial tag, a one-time thing, and use maybe a toll road situation, you know, or a toll bridge situation to pay it off as we went. We could have probably done that as a one-time thing on the tags. And
aren't they doing that now?
I haven't heard anything about the toll road situation as far as using toll fees to pay it off directly, you know, cut down on adding to the debt.
Well, let's get John's take on this. John, aren't we being taxed enough, though? I mean, Douglas has got an idea that just raise it a little bit one time, but is that going to generate enough money?
I suppose it could add a little bit, but I agree. I think we're taxed very highly. If you look at our business taxes, the United States, of any of the developed countries, we have the second highest business taxes in the world. Our top marginal tax rates are well above the average for developed countries. And we have taxes that other countries don't even have in terms of things like capital gains. I mean, there's very few countries that tax capital gains the same way we have here in the United States. And one of the real risks that we have to worry about is driving businesses overseas and away from here and driving a lot of talent that we have. The United States can't forever go and have business taxes. They're much higher than other places. Capital around the world goes to places where it can get the highest return. And if you make it so that they can't get that here in the United States, they're going to go and invest someplace else. There are a couple of things that I wanted to comment on that the caller brought up. And one of the claims, I don't know how many times I keep on hearing this, is that things would have been even worse if they hadn't gone and done these investments, you know, this spending that they have with the stimulus. But there are two points to be making here. One is, if you look at the surveys of economists, Wall Street Journal every month does a survey of the top 50 to 60 business forecasting economists. They all thought in January and February last year that the economy was going to be coming out of the recession in the middle of the year and that we'd start having growth. And, you know, nobody thought that this was going to be going on for a long period of time. I would argue, and even if you look at the administration's own forecast, even the last forecast that they had on February 28th of last year, they were predicting that the unemployment rate for the year was going to average 8.1%. This is after the stimulus was passed. I think what's taking them by surprise is the fact of how much chaos was created by having all this money being moved around in the economy. And, you know, to go and argue that things were much worse than they thought they were, I mean, this is a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, because even after they knew what the numbers were in the fall of 2008 in terms of GDP, they already knew those numbers when they came out with things like their February 28th forecast. Economists in general had seen that. And, you know, as far as these things on bridges and roads, you know, you have to understand and Keynesian type discussions, you know, they say, well, we want to put it on things that are going to be spent. It's when you take money from you or me, when you put money, it's not like you put your money in a mattress or dig a hole in the backyard to put it in. What you do is you put it in the bank. And what does a bank do with it? Banks don't make money sitting on money. What they do is they go and lend it out to somebody else.
Well, they lend it out 10 times, don't they?
Right, right. That's exactly right. And so the problem here is not that you'd go and create new spending by the government taking the money from you and me, because if they take $1,000 from us, we'll reduce some spending that we'd be doing, and we also take some of the money out of the bank that we would have had there in order to pay off
the taxes or give the government more money that they're going to have. And so this notion that somehow they create more spending is just ridiculous. And, you know, I think it's something that governments like to focus on because they like to justify the spending that they want to go and make. But a lot of the spending that created the stimulus was just a long list of programs that Democrats had had for years that they just never could get the votes to go and get through Congress and get a president to sign it. And so all those different programs that they had and lots of different bills were all dumped and rolled together into this thing that we called the stimulus.
All right, let's go next to Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's Brian's turn on Coast to Coast, East of the Rockies. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, I just want to challenge a couple things. One of them was earlier on the housing market. I heard a lot of this being blamed on a certain segment that was forced to take loans, which I don't know if it's referring to redlining or whatnot, but that was a very small portion compared to those that used their homes as piggy banks and the banks that allowed them to. And the thing is that like Freddie and Fannie didn't even allow a bundle that couldn't bundle those high loan value, those high risk loans until I think 2007. But it was the banks that agreed to do these high loans. And it started back in 99 that they got into trouble, and they still allowed it to happen. So that was one thing. The second thing was, which I'm kind of curious about, is with Reagan, I know there's lots of things that, I would have agreed with Reagan on, and I think he did a few good things, but one thing people forget is, he cut all these taxes and whatnot, and then within 2 years he had this huge deficit, and then all of a sudden he was taking back the tax cuts. And a lot of people don't realize it, but 85% of our deficit, starting from before Reagan, 85% of our $11 trillion that Obama had was Reagan, Bush, and Bush. Adding to that, we had a slight decrease, or not total decrease of the deficit, but we were going downward with Clinton. And Clinton actually raised a few of the taxes on the higher rates, and we did fine with that. And Reagan was the first one that came up with this idea that deficits don't matter. So I'm a little curious why Reagan is held up as this great guy that he started this whole thing. And the guy before said something too, is we spend 10 times the amount on our military spending than our next closest potential rival. Why isn't anybody addressing that? The $3 trillion of wars, Bush's stimulus was $1 trillion, basically gave out free money. That didn't work. Nobody objected to that. So, I mean, a lot of these Tea Parties I hear talk about these things, but nobody's addressing these things.
Go ahead, John.
Right. Well, I mean, just we can talk about the last thing you just brought up in terms of the cost of war. I mean, it's true the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have cost something over $700 billion in almost 10 years. That's a lot of money. But in terms on a year-by-year basis, it's relatively small. I mean, we're talking about now, if you add together, I mean, so far we've had two stimulus packages passed. One was $814 billion last February. We recently had the state stimulus package for state government jobs that was $26 billion. These two stimulus packages now that we're talking about are going to add over another $200 billion. So those, in a relatively short period of time of 2 years, are going to end up spending over $1 trillion, almost $1.1 trillion just by themselves. And there are other big changes that have occurred in spending in the last year. You had supplemental spending budgets have been passed several times in the last year, which have added to this deficit. So it's how much huge increase in spending. Now, we can go and argue whether or not there should have been a war or not. That's kind of beyond my purview for whether or not to go and try to justify the Iraq or Afghanistan wars. I'm just saying in terms of the size of the spending that we're talking about, the things that were, if you look on a yearly basis, they're nothing incomparable to, you can take the $700 billion divided by 10 years and you get an idea of what the average was per year and compare it to how much we're talking about per year with these stimuluses, and they're not comparable. And the first thing that you're bringing up with regard to Fannie and Freddie, it's true. We're not supposed to go and bundle in high-risk mortgages in there, but they did. And they essentially committed fraud. If a private company had done the types of things that they had done, people would be in jail. And now, a lot of banks caught on that the Fannie and Freddie were improperly bundling in these extremely risky mortgages along with other mortgages. But the problem was Fannie and Freddie kept on telling everybody that the federal government's going to guarantee these things. And that's essentially what happened. We've spent $400 billion now, and it's, you know, we're spending another $10 to $12 billion every month going and essentially cleaning up these guarantees that Fannie and Freddie have made.
And they keep cropping up, don't they?
Right. Well, they're going to, Fannie and Freddie, if you read their most recent reports from last month, have said these totals of like $10 to $12 billion losses are going to go on as far as they can see in the future. They see no end for when those losses are going to be ending. And, you know, if you take the Reagan deficits, you know, to go to the other question that you have, you know, it's quite different in two different ways. One is, there is a percentage of GDP, they're not even close to what we're talking about now in terms of these deficits. And secondly, I would argue there's a little bit of a difference between having a deficit because you've cut the marginal tax rate versus the type of deficit that we have now from spending. Because the thing about the lower marginal tax rates, at least to some extent, they create more growth, and so you have money that you can go and pay off some of those spending that you're going to be having in the future. It's true, after a couple of years, Reagan did raise the tax rates a little bit, but they were nowhere near equal to the size of the cuts that you have. See, you know, if anything, in the first stimulus package there was for Obama, President Obama, there were some tax cuts, but I would argue that they did the exact opposite thing in terms of stimulating growth, because what they did was they gave people a large deduction, but that deduction phases out as your income goes up. So essentially, the thing that determines your decision to go and work another hour is how much money do you get to keep from that additional hour of work. Well, by having it so that the deduction phases out, it essentially raises the marginal tax rate. It says that not only do you pay taxes, you know, as whatever the federal tax and state taxes would be on that additional dollar, but you lose some of the deduction that you had before. So the real true tax rate is higher than what the simple, you know, tax rates would be from the marginal tax rates for the federal government and the state government, because you're losing that other money. And that discourages you from working more. And so, you know, they've got it exactly backwards. You know, they have the tax cuts, but the tax cuts create the exact opposite incentive that they should be creating.
It's supposed to give you more money, you get less.
Right.
By working harder. Let's go to Joe in Orange County, New York, on the wildcard line. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, guys.
Sure.
A quick comment about the Cash for Clunkers program, which I think was really an iconic example of wrongheaded thinking, and your guest has articulated many other examples and programs. But in my case, and in the case of people in our neck of the woods, in the Tri-County area, Orange, Ulster, Dutchess, Sullivan County, many of us are driving secondhand vehicles and many times secondhand four-wheel drive cars. So what happened in the Cash for Clunkers? It was a real shell game, because people who had perfectly good vehicles, you know, with 50, 60, 70,000 miles, traded them in. I don't know that they saved that much money on a new vehicle, and certainly with four-wheel drives and SUVs, there hasn't been a large increment in miles per gallon. But what happened was, as my mechanic pointed out, and much to my chagrin, because I'm trying to replace an older Jeep, you saw these vast parking lots of wonderfully clean, good vehicles that all got crushed.
Yeah, so wiped out.
Wiped out. So where we need these four-wheel drive vehicles, really, I mean, I'm about 75 miles from Manhattan, and I was born in Manhattan, but in the winter, you really need four-wheel drives around here. very hard to find. And maybe in December, my mechanic's friend will be able to get one for me. But the point is, even my mechanic's family, they were looking for another Ford Explorer, couldn't find it. What I wanted to say about this, the other comment, is that environmentally, and a lot of experts have weighed in on this, if you keep a car for, past a half decade into even a decade and you keep it up, you're actually creating less pollution, because to make a new car, it's a tremendously polluting endeavor. And if you keep a car and just keep it up and keep it running, no matter what MPGs it gets, it will get recycled. And of course, the first recycling enterprise ever in the United States was the car junkyard. They do it rather efficiently. So
I know Jimmy Hoffa's in one of them.
And that's right. But the point is, I think that the Cash for Clunkers was a shell game. I don't think people save that much money, and they destroyed a lot of perfectly good vehicles that would have gotten on the secondhand market, and now so many of us up here are at a loss as to what the heck to do. And I would like your guests to comment on that.
Okay, minute to go, John. Go ahead.
I think it's a really excellent call. I think it's just an example of making us poor. I mean, we could go around, break windows and buildings and create jobs supposedly to go and replace the windows. Why not keep the windows we already have and use the money for something else that would be valuable?
That's right.
On the pollution stuff, this is just an example of kind of government regulatory mind. They only look at one part of the pollution issue here, the miles per gallon. And as the caller correctly states, you use a lot of energy and create pollution to go and build the cars to begin with.
Maybe they should have just all given us a check, John.
Well, it would have been cheaper, or maybe not just take it from us to begin with to then give us a check back.
Or a voucher to buy goods and services in this country. Something.
Right. Well, I mean, there's lots of things that they could have done that wouldn't have left us as poor. Now, we spend the billions of dollars on this Cash for Clunkers thing. And we've destroyed wealth, and it's money we can't get back. And what the big thing our kids are going to have is just a little bit bigger debt that they're going to be having to pay off 10, 20, 30 years from now.
No doubt. John Lott, thank you so much. Up next, astrologer Mark Lerner with his floating format tonight on Coast to Coast AM.